Hello, my name is Gavin Francis, and thank you for listening to this audio recording. This audio recording discusses the exposure draft on impairment and amortized cost of financial instruments. Before we start, I would like to stress that all opinions expressed on this audio recording are those of the individual ISV staff and do not represent the view of the board. So why have we done this audio recording? The exposure draft on impairment and amortised cost differentiates between the proposed accounting treatment of initial expected loss estimates and subsequent changes to expected loss estimates. Some people have asked whether that difference in treatment is justified. So this audio recording is aimed at helping understand the accounting issues and some of the reasoning and arguments around this particular issue. The recording is focusing only on the accounting issues and is not looking at possible operational reasons why those proposals may need to be changed. I'm joined by Martin Friedhoff on the ISB staff, who I'm going to quiz about this issue. So Martin, let's take a step back first and let's have a look at the basic differences between a financial asset and a non-financial asset. And the reason I want to do this is because in the discussions that have been happening, some have been suggesting that we should use some of the non-financial asset requirements or models in the context of financial assets. So before we get into the details, can we just talk about the basic differences?
Yeah, sure. It was actually a question that a couple of board members had early in this project. And the staff explained that the fundamental difference is that for a financial asset, you have contractual specification of the cash flows that you look at. For a non-financial asset, you do your investment, you then derive some revenues from it, you have further operating costs associated with it, so you have many more variable drivers of the return on a non-financial asset. And that results in a fundamental difference in accounting for an integrated calculation that is the return on financial asset and a non-financial asset that has different standards dealing with different parts of the inputs that drive the profitability.
So a financial asset has contractually determined cash flows. Can you just talk about, you mentioned it, what implications does that have, both in terms of one, measurement on the balance sheet, but two, importantly, in terms of the effect on profit or loss, revenue recognition, if you will?
Only when you have these contractual specified cash flows, it allows you to have one integrated calculation that takes you from your initial starting point, say the acquisition cost or your initial drawdown amount for a financial asset, and equates that with all the subsequent cash flows. And that means as part of one calculation, you have both determination of revenue, determination of impairment, and together also that leads back to determining the carrying amount on the balance sheet. And that just can't be done for a non-financial asset.
So that's what we mean when we talk about an integrated revenue recognition and balance sheet measurement approach, which, as you say, is possible in the context of financial assets, but is simply not possible for non-financial assets that don't have contractually specified cash flows.
Exactly.
Okay, we'll come back to this point in a while, but let's now turn to the specific issue that we're here to talk about, and that is the difference between, or proposed difference between, the treatment of initial expected loss estimates and subsequent changes to those estimates. So let's look at the initial expected loss estimates first. Clearly, when someone makes a loan, then baked into the pricing of that loan is some expectation of loss. And that's really what we mean by the initial expected loss estimate. What are the basic accounting choices that we have as to what to do with that initially expected loss?
I think there are basically three ways you can go. What we do today on the IAS 39 is we simply ignore that initially. So even though there is and loss expectation from the outset, it's included in the pricing, it just gets ignored until at a later point in time you have some evidence that you run into trouble and then you deal with it. The second alternative...
So what's the effect of that approach?
The effect of that approach is that you front-load revenue. You essentially recognize revenue on a best-case basis.
So
in best cases, you get all the cash flows.
So essentially, you're recognizing revenue you simply don't expect to get when you make the loan.
Exactly.
Okay. What other choices do you have?
The second choice is you could try to recognize the initial estimate of expected losses right up front because you think there is a loss. But that almost gives you the opposite problem. You then front load the losses and you back load the profitability. Because then you take it all up front and you ignore that you only enter into this instrument because you also get interest and overall, you expect that the interest compensates for the losses that you incur on average.
Okay, so two choices so far. You either backload it, backload the initial expected losses, which is what we do today in 39, or you frontload it, which would create a day one loss issue. So the board didn't go with either of those approaches. What approach did they go with?
The board went for the third approach, and that means that you adjust your contractual interest rate to arrive at a credit cost adjusted return. And they did that because, like you said, they didn't want to either front or backload the losses, which actually introduces artificial volatility over time in your profit and loss. And they also wanted to align interest revenue recognition with the underlying economics, because the economics are you expect the loss from the outset on most lending operations. It doesn't mean that the asset is impaired at that stage. You could typically sell it off for at least that price or even better. And to avoid this disconnect with the economic reality, they went for the third approach, which reflects the rationale for these lending transactions.
So at the moment, we're just focusing on initial expected losses under the approach put forward by the board. Just coming back to where we started this whole discussion, an integrated sort of balance sheet measurement and revenue recognition approach. Under the approach proposed in the exposure draft for initial expected losses, then does that mean that initially the carrying amount of the asset in the balance sheet is essentially the present value of the expected cash flows you expect to get?
Exactly. So, and that is what our approach does. It looks at what carrying amount initially is the present value of the expected cash flows. And that means you have to use a credit cost adjusted return to get you back to your starting point so that the present value is the same as the carrying amount at that point in time.
Okay, now let's turn to the other issue, which is really when you make your initial loss expectations, clearly in most cases, you're going to have to subsequently change them. So the issue that's currently being debated by many is, well, how should you account for those subsequent changes in expected loss estimates? What basic choices, Martin, do you have about how you could treat such subsequent changes in estimates?
You have two broad choices. You can either try to allocate the effect of the change in estimate over the remaining life of the asset, or you can immediately recognize in the period of the change in estimate the entire effect of changing that estimate.
And the exposure draft proposes the latter, whereby the effect of the change in estimates is recognized in the period that change in estimate happens. That's called the so-called catch-up effect or catch-up adjustment, is that right?
Exactly. So the idea is very clear that there is no deferral of the effect of changes in estimate.
What are the implications of those different choices?
Well, if we look at why the board has decided to go with no deferral but immediate recognition of the effect of changes in estimates, there are a couple of reasons for that. One is you're actually using this way of accounting for it reflect that there has been a change in the quality of the asset. Because your initial starting point was you enter into this investment because you have this return expectation that is based on the cash flow expectations at that point in time. If you have to revise your cash flow expectations later on, it means something has changed. You are not expecting to end up where you wanted to end up when you made investment decision. And that's what is the information that we want to relay to investors, that you have a benchmarking of where are you now compared to what was your investment decision to go into this transaction.
So from a balance sheet measurement perspective, what does that mean? What's that figure under the proposals that the board's put forward? What's that figure in the balance sheet represent?
By doing this catch-up adjustment, it means that at any point in time, your carrying amount on the balance sheet is the present value of the cash flows you still expect, discounted using the original effective interest rate.
And if you go for the other approach, the other option that you mentioned, in terms of trying to allocate that, the effect of the changes of expected losses over the remaining period, then what are the implications of that?
Well, the implications are, first, your measurement is no longer at any point in time the present value using the original effective interest rate, which impairs the ability to compare the carrying amount that you have now and the situation you have now to your original investment decision.
And in a cost-based measurement, which is what we're talking about here, that original effective interest rate that we talked about is essentially the link that you have to the cost, to when you initially recognize the asset.
Exactly.
So you lose that link.
Yeah, if you reset the effective interest rate or otherwise use a mechanism to allocate the effect of change in estimates to future periods, it means that your direct link to the original recognition point in time is lost, which creates a doubt whether it is still really a kind of true cost-based measurement.
And if you allocate those effects of changes in estimated losses, what's the balance sheet measurement reflect then?
Well, it's actually quite a problem, because then the time and magnitude of how you revise your estimates will determine where your carrying amount goes in the future. So if you make an estimate one way and later on reverse that, you don't get back to your original glide path to your cash flows as it would have unwound. Compared to our approach, when you make an estimate one way and then reverse that in the next period, you get back to where you would have been if you didn't have this double dip. And so that is a fundamental difference between those approaches. You also get into a problem that your discount rate might become negative, certainly below risk-free, if you reset the EIR.
And that would seem a somewhat strange outcome.
Well, it's, in my view, completely counterintuitive that the risk on the asset goes up. There's more uncertainty whether you collect the cash flows, and yet your discount rate would go down or even become negative. So it doesn't really explain what's going on economically.
Okay, let's just briefly talk about what other IFRSs away from financial instruments require, because there's been some discussion around this issue. Can you talk about, for example, the impairment tests that are required today for some non-financial assets?
Yes, we have a couple of different impairment tests, for instance, for inventories and for property, plant and equipment and other non-financial items. And all of those require that if you identify an impairment, it means you recognize the effect in its entirety in the period when you make the impairment test. So there is no deferral of impairments under those approaches.
And what about pensions? Today, or when we're recording this, actually the ISB has just issued proposals on pensions. Can you talk about that in this context as well?
Yes, our exposure draft is entirely consistent with where the board is going with IAS 19 on employee benefits. So for pension obligations at the moment, you can actually defer the effect of changes in estimates to future periods, and the board has just today issued a proposal that you in the future have to recognize the effect of those changes in estimates immediately.
So essentially, I think what you're saying is today in other IFRS requirements, the effect of changes in estimates are required to be immediately recognized in profit or loss in the period of change.
Yes, you can also look at IAS 37. So it's quite strange that for loan commitments, for instance, you have IAS 37. There's absolutely no doubt that you can't defer any change in estimates under IAS 37. So how would it be consistent if you then change from a loan commitment to a loan and then you start deferring those effects of changes in estimates?
Okay, maybe we can just also talk about IS-8, because I've heard a number of discussions around that, and particularly paragraph 36B, whereby a change in accounting estimates is included in profit or loss in both the period of change and future periods if the change affects both. Can you talk about that in the context of bad debt and also the requirements of IS-8?
Sure. I think there is a fundamental misunderstanding at times as to what a prospective treatment of something means. So when IS-8 talks about treating changes in estimates on a prospective basis, that means it is not treated retrospectively, which means you would open up past accounts and change numbers that have already been determined for previous financial statements. It means you just leave those past statements as they are and only change accounting numbers that are still yet to be drawn up. But it still has two different ways of dealing with prospective changes. One way is immediately reflecting the effect of change in estimates in the period where this change occurs, and the other one is to recognize it in this period and other future periods.
So paragraph 37 of IS-8 states that if a change in accounting estimate gives rise to a change in an asset, then that effect should be recognized by adjusting the carrying amount in the period of change. How is that in the context of bad debts?
Well, the impairment test is the type of change that, albeit on a prospective basis, it still means that you recognize the effect of the change in estimates in the period where you change your estimate. And that is clarified in the next paragraph in IS-8, which expressly refers to bad debt estimates as the type of change that you reflect immediately in your current period. So there's no doubt which type of change it is. Sometimes it gets confused by people with re-estimates of the useful life of property, plant and equipment, for instance, but that is the other case that we can't use here.
Okay, so I think what this all comes back to is, in terms of the proposals and the exposure draft, the basic rationale for proposing a catch-up adjustment for changes in estimates of expected losses subsequent to initial recognition is essentially that the change in estimate causes the present value of the asset to change. That's a gain or loss, and that should be recognised in the period in which the estimate has changed. Is that a fair summary of the thinking that went into the proposals in the exposure draft?
Exactly. We try to be consistent with both existing IFRS requirements for other assets and IS-8 as well.
And sort of bringing it full circle where we started this discussion off, sort of brings it back to this notion of, in the context of financial asset where you have contractually specified cash flows, you basically can, or we do today, take an integrated approach in terms of both balance sheet measurements, which reflects the present value of future expected cash flows, but also the revenue recognition implications determined through the effective interest rate.
Exactly.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Martin. And thank you very much for listening to this audio recording. I hope you found it useful. We've obviously been involved in a number of discussions around these accounting issues, so we thought it would be useful just to set out some of our thoughts and some of the rationale that went into the proposals and the exposure draft. On the ISB website, there is also a short document prepared by the ISB staff that goes through many of the same points that Martin and I have discussed today. So thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.